This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. Home time after a festival, pretty grim, isn't it? Like, you're feeling not the best, safe to say. You're getting all your stuff together, shoving it in the car, nobody's speaking, everyone's battling. And as you're driving out of the campground, you pass mountains of garbage bags, abandoned tents, old eskies, couches even. And you think, oh, there's got to be a better way. Can we do this better next time? Like, you had a great time, but at what cost? Later, we're going to be talking about environmentally friendly partying. How realistic is it? We know some festivals, events are doing it, but can it become mainstream? Also coming up, we've got an update on Tassie's election. We're going to explain what a hung parliament is, why you should know about it. First, though.
Hack.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for that attack, though Putin has blamed Ukraine.
On Triple J.
Yeah, it would have felt like any gig any of us would have been to on a Friday night. Thousands jammed into a massive venue in Moscow. Fans of a Russian rock band getting ready for a good time. But minutes later, horror. A mass shooting and fire that's left more than 130 people dead, another 100 injured. This was an attack, and four men have been charged with terrorism. But while Islamic State, a group the world has come to fear over the past decade, has claimed responsibility, the Russian President Vladimir Putin is pointing his finger at Ukraine, says Ukraine's responsible. Ariana Lucente has more, and just a warning, there's some distressing sounds in here.
On Friday night, fans of the Russian rock band Picnic were filling up seats at a Moscow concert hall. The venue, Crocus City Hall, seats about 6,200 people, and the show had sold out. But before the music even began, this happened. Four gunmen stormed in and began shooting rapid-fire weapons, first in the foyer and next the auditorium. Dave Primov was there.
There were constant volleys of gunfire. We all got up and tried to move toward the aisles. People began to panic, started to run, and collided with each other. Some fell down and others trampled on them.
Videos show attackers spraying gunfire onto the crowd.
It was just a crowd of people that were being shot at. I just can't imagine the scale of the disaster.
Russian authorities say the attackers set fire to the building with explosives and flammable liquid. Anastasia Rodionova was able to escape.
It is unbelievable. You understand only now that you are lucky, really lucky. I came home, my coat was just covered in blood. Apparently someone shielded me with his body.
Russia's investigative committee confirmed at least 130 people were killed, including three children. The victims are still being identified. Health officials say more than 100 people were taken to hospital. Russia's President Vladimir Putin declared a national day of mourning on Sunday.
It's already obvious that we face not just a cynically planned act of terror, but a premeditated mass killing of unarmed people. The criminals had a set goal of killing, shooting our citizens on sight in cold blood.
A branch of the Islamic State group claimed responsibility and released video of the deadly shooting. But Putin reckons Ukraine was behind it, which Ukraine and the US both say is ridiculous.
All four of the actual performers of the act of terror, all those who shot and killed people, were found and detained. They tried to hide and were moving in the direction of Ukraine.
No, there is no whatsoever any evidence, and in fact what we know to be the case is that ISIS-K is actually, by all accounts, responsible for what happened.
ISIS-K, or Islamic State Khorasan, is a branch of the extremist group Islamic State, operating mainly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Analysts say this is a big wake-up call.
ISIS-K has become one of the strongest, if not the strongest, part of the Islamic State today.
This is Dan Byman from the American think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Russia is a longstanding enemy of the broader jihadist community. If you go way back to the struggle in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, there is a dispute within the broader jihadist world between ISIS-K and the Taliban. And it blames the Taliban for being too close to Russia.
There's another twist here. American officials say they shared information with Russia about a planned terrorist attack in Moscow earlier this month. They say they warned that terrorists would potentially target large gatherings, including concerts. But they say Vladimir Putin had dismissed the warnings and said the West was trying to blackmail, intimidate, and destabilize Russia. And now Russia says they've detained the terrorists responsible. In the last few hours, four men, all apparently from Tajikistan, appeared in a courtroom in Moscow charged with acts of terrorism. They were all bruised and injured. One was brought in a wheelchair and apparently missing an eye. Another had a bandage where his right ear should be. At this stage, the men are facing possible life sentences. Some in Russia want the death penalty to be reintroduced.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente with that update. I want to get into this a bit more with someone who can give us some context. Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Alfred Deakin Institute, and he's with us now. Hey, Greg, thanks very much for coming on Hack. A lot of people probably haven't thought much about Islamic State for a few years and maybe have even thought they're not a big threat anymore. But is that true?
Depends where you're living, Dave. If we were living in Africa, West Africa, just south of the Sahara or the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Kenya, we wouldn't be saying that because we would be experiencing regular reports of Islamic State and Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks. But yeah, Europe, Australia, North America, not so much. So this is a kind of a turning point, probably. The group involved in Friday night's attack, ISIS-K, attempted 21 attacks last year, 8 the year before. So they're getting back into the game, it seems.
So can you tell us a bit more about this group? Because it's a bit of an offshoot from Islamic State, isn't it?
It is, and that's the way both Islamic State and Al-Qaeda grow today. They grow through franchises and branches, mostly responding to local opportunities and local grievances. So ISIS-K, the K stands for Khorasan, a word meaning the East, denoting Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and sort of Tajikistan, that area of the world. ISIS-K was formed in 2015 in Afghanistan. The Americans and the Afghans went after it hard, but they couldn't get rid of it. The Taliban came to power. They also can't get rid of it. ISIS-K is now entrenched as an insurgency across the length and breadth of Afghanistan, and it's turned its mind to launching attacks outside Afghanistan. So that makes Russia particularly vulnerable. But the Europeans have interrupted many ISIS-K attack plots over the last 2 years as well.
Right. Well, I want to get into exactly why Russia may have been targeted here, what the reasoning is behind that. But I did want to ask, is it possible that Islamic State is not responsible? Because we know in the past that they've claimed responsibility for attacks which they haven't carried out.
It's almost certain this time around, Dave, they are responsible. They issued a claim through their Amaq news agency. They followed up with a direct claim. Then ISIS-K in particular claimed the attack. The mode of operation we saw on Friday night was very much like the attack in the Bataclan theater in late 2015, assault weapons being used, small grenades or bombs being thrown on a soft target, people at a rock concert. That doesn't fit with the way other groups work. It does fit with the way Islamic State works. The U.S. intelligence services through the U.S. government are confirming that they're convinced that it was ISIS-K. So, you know, as much as we can have certainty in any of these things, it seems pretty certain this at least was ISIS and probably ISIS-K.
But why target this dance hall in Russia, this music hall in Russia?
Well, for Islamic State, Russia is up there with America as one of its big enemies. And of course, since the Soviet days, the Russians often brutally cracked down on Muslim populations in the Soviet days in Soviet republics in Central Asia. Russia has attacked Muslim populations in the North Caucasus. It launched terrible attacks in Chechnya, in Dagestan, in Uzbekistan, really made a name for itself as being intolerant of minorities, and particularly Muslim minorities. It's supported the reign of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Bashar al-Assad probably would have lost control of Syria in 2015 if Russia hadn't stepped in with air support and on-the-ground military support.
Greg, is it possible Islamic State more broadly is building power around the world at the moment? And I know that you have just said that in many parts of the world they're absolutely still operating at a really high level, that there are constant attacks taking place. But could this be the start of something a lot bigger?
And sadly, it looks like that's the case. I mean, as I said, ISIS-K was responsible for 21 attack plots last year, which was up from 8 the year before. And before that, we only knew of 3 that involved them. So it seems to be a sharp upward curve. They're the one branch that's really looking outwards. They've got this safe havens in Afghanistan, but they've got people across Central Asia and Russia and Europe also supporting them. So they've got the means and the will to launch international attacks, whereas the African Islamic State groups are sort of busy with local issues. And it seems like Islamic State's decided that ISIS-K is the vehicle it will use to rebuild its international brand through international attacks.
Right. So presumably leaders all through Europe, but even as far away as Australia, would be looking at this thinking the threat is really real in other countries around the world.
Well, yeah, you're right. An indication of this is that France has just lifted their terrorism alert level to the highest ever level. So it's, you know, it's at maximum level. Of course, Olympics 3 months out, you can see why they'd be worried.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Professor Greg Barton from Deakin University, a global Islamic politics expert, about this attack that we've seen in Russia over the weekend and implications not only for Russia but the rest of the world. Greg, as we've heard, Russia is blaming Ukraine, despite the US saying it warned Russia about an Islamist terrorist threat. Do you think that Vladimir Putin is going to continue to implicate Ukraine?
Yeah, you've got to put yourself in Vladimir's position, Dave. The Americans had warned him about an ISIS-K planned attack on something like a music venue in Moscow. He said publicly, that's nonsense, you're just trying to defame Russia and make us look bad. Now what the Americans and other Europeans actually had warned has come true. So what is Vladimir Putin going to do? Either he says, look, mea culpa, I was wrong, the Americans were right. Or he says, no, it's those dastardly Ukrainians have opened the borders, they let these terrorists come from their territory. So it's the latter option which you'd go for if you were Vladimir, because you don't want to admit you're wrong. It makes you look weak. And this is a crisis for him, but it's a crisis he can make into an opportunity by using it to redouble efforts to recruit, maybe even to conscript people to go and fight in Ukraine, and otherwise just distract and deflect.
I also saw a report that senior politicians in Russia are advocating for the reinstatement of the death penalty. Do you think that's likely to happen?
I think it's likely that it will at least be hanging there as something which is legally possible, if not necessarily widely used. It's striking that up to the moment you can get arrested for the smallest thing and spend a decade in jail in Russia. But capital punishment, you know, doesn't occur. So, yeah, that would be a big shift if capital punishment was at least a theoretical possibility. And that's given everything that's happened in Russia, the slide from a hard authoritarian state with some open aspects of society to a completely closed state with no independent media means that that's the direction we're seeing Russia move in.
Professor Greg Barton, research professor in global Islamic politics from Deakin Uni. Appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thanks, Dave.
Hack on Triple J.
And if you want to know more the developments on this, obviously, yeah, those arrests have been made, the charges, see how it plays out over the next few days. ABC News has the latest updates. You can also check out Hack's Instagram.
Hack.
It's too early, I think, for people to be saying who the next government of Tasmania will be.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we've been talking a bit about Tasmania's election recently. Remember all the uproar over the footy stadium? Well, the election happened over the weekend, but there's still a lot to play out. It's not over. The Liberal Party has claimed victory in Tassie, but the results reveal a hung parliament, which means that the Liberal Party is going to have to form a minority government. You might be asking, what does that mean? I don't really understand it. It tells us actually a bit about voter trends around the country. So it's relevant to everyone, even if you're not in Tasmania. Angel Parsons explains.
Wow. What a day.
It's Saturday night in Tasmania, and inside the official tally room at the Rest Point Casino in Hobart, Liberal Party supporters are clapping and cheering.
Thank you all. I very much appreciate your time tonight, and thank you each and every Tasmanian.
Leader of the Liberal Party, Jeremy Rockcliffe, is confident he'll remain Premier of Tasmania. Here he is claiming victory in the election.
An historic fourth consecutive win for the Liberal Party of Tasmania.
But there's a catch. The Liberals might have won more seats than any other party, but they haven't won enough to form a government on their own.
The Liberal Party will not be getting a majority.
Jeremy Rockcliffe's rival was Labor leader Rebecca White, And this is what she had to say on election night.
Tasmanians have humbled a Premier who called an early election expecting to be returned in majority.
The results from the Tassie election show what's called a hung parliament. But what the heck is that? Well, there are 35 seats or members in Tasmania's lower house. Well, at the moment there is. There's a bit of history here. There were 35 seats decades ago, but that got reduced to just 25. Until a few years ago, when concerns about ministerial burnout prompted a change back to 35 seats. Basically, with only 25 MPs, nearly everyone had to do multiple jobs. Anyway, to form government the easy way in the expanded parliament, a party needs half of the seats plus one extra, so 18 or more. Looking at the results so far today, the Liberal Party won 13 and Labor won 10. So not exactly a vote of huge confidence for either, as Federal Treasurer and Labor Party member Jim Chalmers put it.
We would have liked to have done better, but the Liberals certainly don't have anything to crow about.
The major parties are falling short of being able to form majority because votes went elsewhere. Outside of Tassie, we're seeing this happen too, with more people supporting smaller parties and independents, like all those Teal MPs who got elected at the federal election 2 years ago. In Tassie, there's so far an almost 12% swing away from the Liberals. Most of that benefited the Greens, who won 4 seats, independents with 2 seats, and the Jackie Lambie Network, also with 2. And these members are called crossbenchers. Labor has admitted defeat, so to form government, the Liberal Party will need to secure support from those crossbenchers, either by entering a formal agreement or by offering deals with every bit of policy they want to get passed. Here's Tassie's two major party leaders recently on why this isn't ideal.
Minority government is destabilising, destroys confidence.
Dealing with a crossbench the size of Tasmanian community looks to have returned in this election will be a very difficult task for them to manage with respect.
Members from Federal Senator Jackie Lambie's network, for example, could be crucial to helping the Liberals form a minority government.
To make sure there's a government form, because I'm quite sure that Tasmanians do not want to go back to a re-election over the next 2 months.
So how are those negotiations going to go? Well, a lot of the minor parties want a rethink about Hobart's AFL stadium.
People were devastated that a government would choose to spend over $1 billion.
There are more important things down there to people, like our health system.
What do young people think about this debate over the stadium?
There are certainly young people that do support a stadium and an AFL team, and there are those that don't. We believe as a peak body that investment needs to be allocated to respond to the health, social and economic needs of all Tasmanians, including young people.
Tanya Hunt, CEO of the Youth Network of Tasmania, was telling me that young people's views on employment, housing, health, transport and climate change have felt invisible this election.
And while the focus is currently on forming government at the moment, it's likely that the needs of young Tasmanians will continue to be ignored.
What is the kind of tangible outcome that you really want to see?
We would like to see a dedicated Minister for Youth in Cabinet. We would like to see a dedicated standalone child and youth housing and homelessness strategy. 39% of Tasmania's homeless population is under the age of 25 years, and sadly, their needs and housing solutions have not been reflected.
And it could still be a few more days, if not weeks, before we know which politicians will be in charge.
Hack on Triple J.
Angel Parsons with that update. Yeah, we'll be hearing a lot more about these results in the weeks ahead. There's all this speculation. The Labor leader, Rebecca White, might not be around for much longer. She's considering her future after 3 straight losses. So there's a bit happening. There'll be more announcements, some messages on the text line. Someone says if the major parties stop sucking so hard, then they'd have a better chance of a majority. And someone else says a hung parliament sounds like something from Urban Dictionary.
Hack.
Why is it that everyone has to buy single-use camping gear and then the festivals have the responsibility of cleaning up?
On Triple J.
When getting ready to go to a camping festival, how much do you think about what you don't need? Because we all think about what we might need, and there's a lot of stuff. Wet weather gear, hot weather gear, all the camping accessories you're definitely not going to use. Waste is an enormous issue at festivals.
Does it surprise you to know that each person creates 2 kilos of waste per day at a festival? And that's not all beer cans and chip packets. We're talking abandoned tents, marquees, even couches. And a lot of it heads to landfill. So how do we change this? ABC Warrnambool reporter Olivia Sanders has been speaking to some people who were taking responsibility for festival waste.
The setting of Port Fairy, people are just so friendly and willing to learn as well, which is really important.
Miranda's been coming to the Port Fairy Folk Festival with her family for 8 years. This is her first time volunteering, cleaning up after the fun's over. Being a bin fairy might not be all that glamorous, but it's a cause that's super important to her.
We're trying to educate ways people need to be separating their rubbish correctly, which doesn't seem like a big thing, but when you have hundreds and hundreds of people coming through a festival, bins getting contaminated, plastic being thrown in the compost, everything gets messed up, and as soon as you have that contamination, it all goes to waste. So it's really important that we're educating.
Australia is home to more than 500 festivals each year. And Green Music Australia, which tries to make the music industry more environmentally friendly, says the average festival goer creates about 2 kilos of waste a day. A bunch of Aussie music festivals are trying to do better, like having reusable cups, colour-coded bins for sorting waste, and even hiring compostable toilets. But 50 to 80% of festival waste actually comes from campsites. And despite Leave No Trace messaging, festival grounds are often left scattered with abandoned tents, marquees, and even couches. Self-described doof lover Lily Walker started Good Intentions Camping with some mates back in 2020 as part of a university project.
I love doofing and I hated going to festivals and the feeling of helplessness at the end and just the absolute trash that would be just proliferated throughout the site.
Good Intentions are on a mission to save abandoned camp gear from landfill by collecting it, fixing it, and hiring it out at festivals. Lily says the model is better for everyone.
It's better for the festivals and their PR relationships with their customers. I also think that from the punter's perspective, it's easier, it's more convenient, and really nobody wants to leave their stuff.
And now instead of leaving camp gear on site, punters can donate it to Good Intentions to make sure it gets a second life. Melbourne-based fashion designer Rachel Kelly is working to increase awareness of festival waste through her sustainable label Etu Etu, giving abandoned tents a new life as bags.
What I'm not talking about is broken tents and chairs. Like, when you get 10,000 people together, inevitably there's going to be some broken equipment. I am seeing absolutely brand new tent waste that has been used for the single purpose of that event.
After a decade working in fast fashion, Rachel says she started to notice some of the same habits and mindsets creeping into the festival space.
I think a lot of Australians, when they think someone's abandoned a tent, like, they must be sick in the head. You know, like, because, like, why would you do that? But then when you correlate it to fast fashion, you go, oh, it's the same behaviour as buying a nice dress for the weekend that you know you're never going to wear again, you're going to throw it out. Like, it's the same thing. You're just not wearing a tent on your body.
Rachel says the Australian government needs to learn from France, where fast fashion legislation has just passed the lower house. It involves imposing tariffs on low-quality textiles and banning marketing of textiles that are detrimental to the environment. While the French regulations are designed to target fast fashion manufacturers, it would impact cheaply made camp gear too.
Sometimes we look at festival waste in a bubble, but I think that there's so many learnings that we could be taking on. And as a consumer, you know, a lot of people are voting with their dollar when it comes to fashion. I would really encourage to vote for your dollar when it comes to the tent you buy. Do you need a $14 tent made out of polyester?
It's a sentiment Lily Walker agrees with.
If you're planning to go to more than one festival in your life, invest in some good camping gear. If you don't have the funds or the space, or if you're coming interstate for that kind of thing, there are rental options out there.
Hack on Triple J.
Olivia Sanders reporting there, production assistance from Jean Bell as well. A lot of comments coming through on this one. On the text line, Matt says maybe festivals need to have allocated camping spots for people. So then to be able to leave, you'd need to have your site checked before you can go. We've run it this way for different scouting events and there's barely any rubbish to clean up after an event. On Instagram, someone says, take responsibility for yourself. No one's your slave. You are no one else's slave. Stop being so selfish. And some other people are saying Party in the Paddock doesn't look like this. They do an amazing job. Someone saying Splendour last year did a really good job. They were really impressed. Let's get into this more now. Berish Balanda is the CEO of Green Music Australia, which is a group working to make the music industry more environmentally friendly. And he's with me now. Berish, thanks for coming on Hack.
Absolute pleasure. Delighted to be here.
Realistically, can mainstream festivals ever be sustainable?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's not rocket science what we're talking about, you know. The milk used to be delivered in reusable glassware and you finished your milk and you put it out and the milky collected it and returned the bottle the next day filled with milk. You know, I think we can look to the past for future scenarios that are going to help ease the problem. And I think where we've gone wrong is the single-use culture that we've promoted.
So do you think that to change this for festivals, for other music events, it's not just about focusing on the event, but it's about focusing on the culture more broadly? Like, for instance, if you've got someone who's really into fast fashion, it's about making them see that that is also an issue and the flow-on effects are not just for music festivals but across society.
Oh, look, I think the way you deal with a big, gnarly issue like this is from multiple angles. So, you know, government has a role to play in making sure that cheap and nasty gear isn't hitting shelves. And festival organisers have a role to play in doing everything they can in the arena that they control. And I think fans have a role to play as well in making sure that if they want to camp, you know, semi-regularly, then they should invest in decent equipment because it's not going to break on the first day when they rock up at the festival. It's going to last them a lifetime and they're going to enjoy the experience. That's certainly what I did when I was a kid going to Falls Festival. But if they're not interested, if it's just like a one-off event and they want to have fun with their mates, you know, maybe they should be looking to rent a tent or rent a marquee or find something that's sitting in someone's garage. You know, there's many ways to do better. And I think the last thing you want to do is run off to Kmart or one of the other cheaper stores and purchase a $20 tent and find it breaking in the first day of use.
Well, people are definitely running to the shops just before they head out to the campgrounds. You know, I've done it before. It's definitely a thing. We've got messages coming through. Good to see people shouting out the good festivals as well. Someone's saying, shout out to Party in the Paddock. Another credit there to Party in the Paddock. They say they killed it this year. You hardly knew anyone was there. Keegan says Lockhart Music Festival in Victoria is an amazing independent festival that is zero waste. It can be done if organisers want to, but the bottom line, how much it costs, is the biggest factor. How much has it changed in the last few years, Berish? Like, do you think things have actually got worse, or are you starting to see some positive signs?
Look, we've been campaigning on this at Green Music Australia for a good decade, and we've seen actually, I would say things are moving in the right direction. You know, more and more it's pretty common to see a reusable cup system in place, which, you know, for those that are listening, that's where you put a small deposit down and you get a cup that you can use for a duration of time. You can swap it out for a fresh one. And it's putting value on the receptacle as just, it's just a mode of getting that drink into your mouth. You know, it's not a piece of waste that you're going to throw out after one use and fill up the bins, which creates a whole range of problems downstream. So I think we just need to do the same thing when it comes to a whole range of other gear. You know, you start with cups and bottles and you got to work your way through to the crockery that we use for the food stalls and eventually the camping gear that we bring if it's a multi-day festival. And I'm seeing a heap of festivals move in the right direction. You know, there's groups like Strawberry Fields that introduced 100% reusable crockery system. You know, Untitled Group that run Pitch and Beyond the Valley have started to branch out and do the reuse system as well. WOMAD have been long at it, and others are mentioning Party in the Paddock and Lockhart. Like, they're festivals that we've worked with, and they're really taking this seriously. And I think festivals can do quite a bit. But, you know, I should mention that fans have a role to play in this in this as well.
Hack on Triple J.
And a big response from people who are keen to see some action on festivals and big music events becoming more sustainable, willing to put in the hard yards to make it work. And I guess that's it, right? Everyone's got to change, as we just heard, whether it's the event organisers, but also you as the patrons when you're there. Hey, that is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll be back tomorrow. We'll catch you then. See ya.